Welcome to Talent Hub Talk. I'm Ben Duncombe, and on this podcast, I will be interviewing prominent and inspirational figures from both the local ANZ and global Salesforce Ohana. In today's episode, I'm joined by Chris Moyes. Chris is one of the co-founders of Proximity Insight, a Salesforce AppExchange product for the retail industry. It was great to hear more about Chris's education, what he wanted to be growing up, and the early stages of his career. Chris also shed some light on another business that he formed while he was studying for his MBA, and then what led him into the Salesforce ecosystem and the roles that he initially played. We hear more about some of the other apps that Chris and his business partner Matt initially started developing, and then what led them into the retail sector with Proximity Insight. We hear more about the challenges they've faced along the way and what makes the product really successful today. We discuss the skill sets required in a product business compared to the consulting world, and then discuss the hardest thing about building a product on the Salesforce platform. This was a really inspiring episode, and I really hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I did recording it. And if you do, please do subscribe for future episodes that are coming through. So Chris, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited to chat. So thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
I think you're actually the first person we've had from a product company, a founder of a product company, talking about products, but also the kind of journey to getting there and your life beforehand. So I'm really keen to hear all about you and not just the product. Let's look way back before your career, your education, you wanted to be growing up. Can you give us some insight into that?
Yeah, so through school, I had no idea realistically. I was pretty good at maths and science, and I think I pulled out a newspaper article that showed the highest paid careers, and I looked at the courses that I could get into, and I just basically went, top one. I started in electronic engineering, actually. So I started electronic engineering and realized very, very quickly that was not for me. I was enjoying all the maths and the computer side of that, but the actual science and physics was not great. So I transferred after 6 months and did 6 months overseas and then came back and did computer science. So I did computer science. I got a developer role in rail software, train software. Worked in that for a while and then realized that even though coding came pretty naturally to me, I wasn't the best coder just because I didn't have the patience and the detail. So pretty quickly, I tried to move into business analyst and management. And that's really why I started doing my MBA, was to sort of show people I wasn't just a developer and I had some skills. So quite often through my career, I've used education as a way to pull myself into an area that I was interested in rather than just what I was pigeonholed in at that point in time.
Sure. So the decision to go into an MBA was to kind of broaden your offering and show that you weren't just a developer, but did you always have that plan to be a business owner? And did you always have that kind of spirit of an entrepreneur?
Yes, always entrepreneur and business owner. I think even through uni, I sort of realized that I was around people that were more technical focused and I was more people focused. So I knew that I was always sort of going to be more of a analyst, business analyst, somewhere in between business or someone wanting something and the technical people. So I kind of always knew that. But then as far as the entrepreneurial side, I always had something on the side. I think a lot of people back in the 90s .com boom, I started an online t-shirt business. I started all sorts of websites that I'd try and build and promote different things. But yeah, not until I really sort of got dug into my MBA did I sort of start moving forward with some real ideas.
Yeah, so I've heard the story about you started a business as kind of something that you could run alongside your MBA so that you could utilize the skills you were learning to see if it was actually coming off. And you got into the field of laser hair removal.
Correct. Yeah. So I was actually working for a company that was selling cosmetic lasers. So I knew the industry pretty well and I knew what people were doing and how much money they were making. So as a part of my MBA, I think I was doing an innovation and entrepreneurship subject at the time. I did a case study, basically a business plan, proving that the Adelaide market was about 2 or 3 years behind the Sydney market and the prices were 3 times as much. And it all just made sense to have a sort of similar chain type laser clinic in Adelaide. It was all doctors at the time. So I did that case study and then just basically went to a few friends and said, look at this it's pretty obvious that, you know, we don't have to put too much money into this. It's pretty hard to lose money from doing this. Why don't we give this a go? So that's sort of how it all started, and definitely didn't sort of see what was coming next. It's sort of, it's grown into one of the biggest chains in Australia now.
So was that your first entrepreneurial success, or was the t-shirt online business, does that one dwarf it still?
No, that was definitely the biggest success. And, you know, I think that gave me the confidence of going out on our own and really giving a crack for a product business.
Sure. So one question I have about that, and I think it was that business, but you implemented Microsoft Dynamics for a company in 2008, which I'm guessing would have been the laser business.
That was the business that was selling the lasers, yeah. When I was in with them, I did a lot of operations, and I actually learned how to fix lasers through that. As a part of that, I implemented Microsoft Dynamics as well. You know, I was trying to transition away from Rail software to CRM, and the Rail software, I was doing .NET and Microsoft databases, so the transition to Dynamics was pretty easy.
Yeah.
So learned Dynamics, and through that process did a whole bunch of research on CRMs in general, and could clearly see that SaaS web-based products technology had sort of hit that tipping point that it was going to be mainstream and go from strength to strength. So that's where I really tried to double down on Salesforce and do all the learning and certifications that I could to get out of Microsoft and get into the Salesforce space.
Sure. So it wasn't your idea to implement Dynamics?
It was my idea, because I knew the Microsoft database better than anything else. So we were just using Microsoft Suite in the company. So it was just basically a free add-on for us at the time.
Okay, cool. So then you kind of found this Salesforce platform and saw that there was potential growth there. How did that career transition from what you were doing before into now being someone that's been in the Salesforce ecosystem for a long time?
Yeah, so I guess it's been a pretty long journey. So I started pretty much knowing nothing. Must be, yeah, I haven't even seen 10 years ago, maybe even more than 10 years ago. Started in a consulting company called Quattro at the time. They got bought out by Deloitte just after I left. But, you know, it was a great experience because the team was very, very dev heavy and not so, at the time, a lot of the typical Salesforce consultants were very pointy click and basic implementations. But for the team, headed by Chris Mao as far as development, we had a team that were computer scientists first and then Salesforce dev second. So I think I really fit into that environment, pretty well. And we got to deliver some really cool implementations. We did a lot of custom mobile apps, and I learned a lot through that process. And by the time I finished there, I was sort of leading the consulting practice.
Yeah, nice. I often see Quattro pop up on CVs from way back, and you always it looks like it was a pretty cool company to work for, like real top devs. I can imagine it was a fun time.
Yeah, like any sort of startup, it's a bit of a roller coaster, and you win some, you lose some, and it was hard work. But yeah, it was a really good team, fun team, and it was definitely fun, the stuff that we were building.
Yeah, nice. And I know obviously you've moved heavily into product and application development. I was looking at your LinkedIn profile when I was researching for this, and your current business isn't your first delve into the product world, because there is still a live website, actually, if you click on one of your old businesses.
Yeah.
And you were building apps for Salesforce way back when. So can you tell us a bit about what some of those early days of app development looked like, and the kind of things you played around with?
Yeah, so that's when Matt Lacey and I decided that, consulting was for suckers, and we wanted to build a product company. And the Salesforce ecosystem, obviously, we had the knowledge and a lot of connections there. So we decided to build some products, but we also knew that we weren't going to solve the problem straight away, and we had to learn, and we had to build and learn and understand how to get a product to market and market it and all of those things. So pretty much what we did was scoured the ideas exchange, scoured the Q&A boards, and just found ideas. And we had a few ideas from consulting, and we just decided to build them out quickly and put them online. So we've got a number, and there's a number of different things out there that we've created. So things that you're talking about from Speakeasy was, Chattermate, which was an automation thing around chatter, notifications and all sorts of stuff. We had Ring My Bell, which I think was the most popular, which for distributed sales teams, a little bell would ring on the screen and everyone would know that a sale was made. And, you know, I think a big learning on that is if we actually took that seriously, we did that one as a free app to start with, and then we did it for like 1 cent or something like that, just to play around with different models. And, you know, I think if we committed to that, I think we could have actually built a, you know, quite a decent business around that. What else did we do? We did a dossier, so documenting the org app.
Yeah.
And we've also, so CrowdGuide, which is actually run out of Train the Crowd,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure you'd know Alice.
Yeah.
So we built that app for Alice as well. So yeah, we definitely played around. We learned a lot about sort of just in general, when you're getting a product to market, Salesforce Path, they give you a lot of guidance, but bringing a product to market is complicated. There's a lot more to it than just, you know, selling something and then going in and implementing it and walking away and selling something else. So we knew we had a lot to learn. We knew it would be multiple years before we sort of cracked the code. So yeah, we had a bit of fun and built some things and it worked. And yeah, a few years later, we got onto Proximity Insight.
Yeah, so where did that come from? Where was the idea? And at this point, also, I should ask, with the original apps, you were cranking code, you were developing at that point as well?
Me personally, I've never been the best. As I said, I've never been the best developer. So yeah, as far as Salesforce developer and technical architect, that sort of thing, and building, you know, all the basic Salesforce stuff for sure. But Matt Lacey is definitely the mastermind behind all the development, and he's one in a million as far as speed, and he's just one of those developers that really knows the reasons why as well. You don't have to tell him all the reasons why. It's just like, okay, we need to build this, and he'll actually ask the right questions for the users and won't just take it at its word. Okay, you've said that, I'm just going to build that. He'll actually digest it, think about what the user experience will be, you know, the technical limitations, and then actually come back and ask questions to get to the right answer rather than just building stuff. So yeah, Lace is definitely more the technical side. I'm more the business side.
Sure. So yeah, Proximity came to you, and it was, as you say, cracking the code. So how did that come about? Is it in a field in which you guys had any experience?
No, not at all. I think the seed got started when we were, I think it's the 2014 or 2015 hackathon, the $1 million hackathon at Dreamforce. We built out a iBeacon solution that our vision of it was, you know, people are walking around, they're walking into stores and they're getting greeted better, whether it's stores or gyms or whatever. The basics of it is you're walking in, you get greeted in a better way, and everyone feels better about themselves. That was sort of the premise. And so we built that out, and a few retailers sort of took notice, and we were just talking to them about it. So we actually gave that a crack for a while, sort of more iBeacon trigger based sort of solutions. We actually got some real good traction in, you know, one of the top gyms in the US, but in retail it was just a bit creepy, to be totally honest. And the technology in general was, I think, a good idea by Apple and everyone, but again, back to the reality of what that technology is doing, and it's triggering things based on you being in a location. So the only way they can make that less creepy is to have a lot of barriers. So you need your Bluetooth on, you need to accept, you know, your location services, and typically now you have to accept all the privacy rules. So there's a lot of barriers to entry. So what that ends up happening is app adoption drops off, and even if the app adoption is still there, a lot of people won't accept all of those terms. So then you're not getting the mass that you really need for it to be valuable.
Sure. How did things develop over, so from having that initial idea to then building those conversations with retail chains, and then to where you are now? How have the last few years kind of developed?
Yeah, so probably after a year of going around, I think the other assumption that we made is we saw the Burberry story at Dreamforce year after year, and saw this great story of having CRM in the store and how amazing it is. And I think we made an assumption that that was commonplace, and that was an assumption that we were very far off. So when we went to retailers and pitched this iBeacon idea and how we can trigger all these amazing activities, and signboards are going to change based on people going to be in there, they just sort of looked at us blankly and said, okay, yeah, you know, that's 5, probably 10 years off anything that we can do. And what we realized pretty quickly was, clienteling, the concept of clienteling. So for people that don't know clienteling, it's, you know, the really basic sense, it's bringing CRM into a store environment or in the hands of a retail associate that they can interact with their customers easily. So this concept of clienteling is only being used by the top tier retailers, and it's not commonplace. And we've built a lot of mobile solutions for pharmaceuticals and alcohol companies, and we're like, well, you know, this is a very clear transition to something, you know, similar technology that we've built, but in retail. So we saw a real big opportunity of building this retail basically operating system for the store, this mobile operating system for the store. So we started getting to work, and we knew we had the retail gap, but we didn't have the retail expertise on you know, between the two of us. So, you know, the reason why we got into it, because we had a bit of a network of people that were in retail. So very quickly we started building a team of retailers to get on board, as far as getting on board our team. And then we got our initial pilot customers, which I sold much like a consulting project, and sold it basically saying, okay, here's a prototype, here's our roadmap, here's what we need to build. It's gonna cost about $500,000 to build, but we'll split the cost across, you know, five retailers, and we'll take some of the cost ourselves. So this is a really cheap way for you guys to get not only what you want, so you get to drive the roadmap of what we're going to build, but you're going to get a product for a lot cheaper than what it would cost if you go to market. That was the approach to get us going. So then I guess that's another year of basically building and implementing those initial pilot customers. And probably the year after that was a year of proving it out, like getting the results, showing ROI. And then I guess that's probably leads us up to about 2017, 2018. And then since then, I guess a roller coaster of successes and challenges and to get where we are. And we're just about to go through a big round of funding and put our foot down and go even harder.
So obviously there's some real challenges at the moment in terms of COVID and being in a store, but on a good day, what does the product enable a sales rep to do? What kind of conversations is that driving for your customers?
It's amazing. So we've got a lot of functionality now, you know, video chat, appointment booking, just a whole suite. As I said, it's basically a retail operating system. You've got all sorts of different options, but really at its core, and the thing that drives the most ROI, is the ability for the store people to have a personal relationship. And probably the biggest ROI piece is just for new customers or customers that are purchasing to say thank you from the person that actually served you. Out of almost all the different bits and pieces, we can prove ROI just on that element. And, you know, I think a lot of retailers were doing that, but they couldn't really do it at scale. The tasks and reminders and templates weren't getting driven to their team. So basically what was happening was their top sales associates were doing it to their top tier customers, and they had really good engagement, and that's why the top 1-2% of customers are, you know, driving 50% of the revenue. But basically we looked at that and said, we can scale this out for your top 10% of customers, and if you can get that top 10% of customers to be acting like your top 1 or 2% of customers because they're getting that personal buy-in. And retail, the one thing with retail, it's very emotional. It's a very emotional thing. So if you feel like the brand cares for you, you really get buy-in into the brand as well, and people get really emotionally tied to brands based on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So for going from consulting way back to building a product, and I think like I have a lot of conversations with devs predominantly that have this idea that they want to be a product business or own a product in the future. What are the hardest parts of that? Like, how does it differ so much from consulting, and what are the skills that you need in product businesses that perhaps aren't so relevant in consulting?
Yes, yeah, so this is there's I guess a lot of different elements, and it depends on the stage of the business. But yeah, I think just to start with, a product business, you're going to be starting a startup. So starting a startup, you know, even if it is a consulting one, but just starting a startup, it work, and it takes a lot longer than you think. You know, you read a lot. It's 3 years to basically become a business and 7 years to make a success. You know, there's not many shortcuts to that. And, you know, from doing this a few times now, I can see it with both the clinics and the stuff that I'm doing now. It's with Proximity Insight. Both of them have gone pretty well, but it takes time, and it's a slog. And the thing that makes someone get through a startup is hard work. And when people are telling you it's going to fail, you keep going. Like that is the key traits of someone that's building a product or a startup. But then I guess just product in general, it is really that creating of something, you know, creating something that a lot of people are using. So traits of people that are good at that, you know, really focused, really detailed, because this isn't consulting. We're not just delivering something that's going to be used with one company. It's going to be used with hundreds of companies and thousands of users. So it needs to be solid. It needs to be robust. The documentation needs to be detailed. You know, there's probably a lot more detailed people in product companies. And I say that as not a detailed person. It's not exclusive, but you need more detailed people in a product company. And I guess because of that, you know, you work as a team more. So there's more of a culture of team building, and you know, we're a team. We're building this together. Typically, you won't get paid as much, but you will get options and shares as someone coming into a business. And definitely, if you're thinking about building a product company, you need buy-in from the people that you're bringing on board. So if you're thinking about starting one and being a founder, you need to build a mechanism to be able to get your really star players bought in, which is, you know, those options and share and equity.
Yeah, and if you look, obviously you've been outspoken about how strong Lacey is in his area of expertise. How important, obviously it's important to have someone with that skill set if you're building a product, but how important do you feel, and this is an obvious answer, but to have those, like you were the business focused guy, he was the technology focused guy. If you were both devs, would it have been successful, do you think?
Potentially. So, you know, devs can build products for devs. And, you know, I think it depends on the complexity of the sale and the implementation. Like sales and implementation for a B2B product company are hard. So that's the real challenge. And I think, you know, we've always focused on the product and customer success. And I think if, you know, if I went back and told myself 7 years ago, I would have said, you know, you really have to start ramping up your sales team a bit earlier. Product and customer success will only get you so far. You actually need the sales element. And I think coming from a consulting background, I was very resistant because it feels like you're just always selling. You know, I wanted to build something that was really valuable and I could show ROI. But even if you can show ROI, if you don't actually have someone that's selling that ROI, you can't just build it and people will come in B2B sales. I think maybe in B2C a little bit more. But in B2B, you need a sales engine. People have POs, people have sign-off mechanisms, people have all sorts of challenges. You can get people excited, but you need people to be able to work through the challenges of enterprise sales.
Yeah, and that model that you had where you kind of brought companies into the journey and said, like, this is our roadmap, you're going to be one of five pilots and you're going to support the kind of investment into this platform. Is that common?
I don't know. I don't know if it's common. I definitely know other people that have done it. I think that was probably just our consulting background and a cheeky way to get funding without getting funding and giving up without giving up early equity. Which, you know, that's obviously, that served us well, that we didn't need to get the early rounds of funding and those investors pushing us in ways we may not have wanted to. We've had a chance to build the product and build the team how we wanted to. And now that we're sort of ready to scale, we can bring those investors in and really just replicate what we've got.
Yeah, because that sounds genius to me, the way that you went about it. Kind of reduces your risk and helps bring people into that journey and they're kind of customers for life, right, once they've had they've helped shape the product.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a bit of dumb luck. It wasn't a well thought out strategy. I think it's, you know, we did a few things like that through our consulting time to reduce the cost of a project. So I just sort of put two and two together and put that strategy into a product play, and it worked, you know, worked really well for us in those early days.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And for anyone listening or watching that isn't aware of how things stand for you as a business now, you're in the US, you're in Australia and the UK?
That's correct. Yep. So I started when I was in the US and pretty much all our early customers were in London. So we built the company with Matt in Melbourne. I was in New York and most of our customers in London. So we're global from day one, which I don't recommend people do. But again, it's one of those things that long term really plays into your favor being a global company. But dealing with tax and finances across different regions when you're only a handful of people is not something I'd recommend.
Sure.
But now head office is in London. We're growing rapidly. You know, we've got the Chris Wood, the old head of retail for Salesforce from the UK. Kathy was VP level at Burberry, our CEO, and you know, really, really strong retail team. So yeah, really, really exciting, and customers in each region and growing in each region. So it's an exciting time. We're still only a small team. We're still only 25, and you know, being global and only 25 people is still a bit of a stretch, but moving into the next phase when we can have fully self-sufficient units in each country is going to be a huge benefit.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of you, I think of a much bigger team than 25. I think it's that's surprising. I thought numbers were larger just because I know the business has been really successful and in three different regions and stuff. To achieve so much with such a small headcount is, yeah, people have been working hard, put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, you know, that's the benefit of the Salesforce platform for sure. You know, our main competition are all have 300 plus people, you know, 500 million in funding, and we're beating them out on deals. You know, it's pretty amazing. And that's the, you know, the security, the scalability, the globalization of the Salesforce platform. So that's, you know, that's all the positive sides of being in the ecosystem and being on a Salesforce platform. There's negatives and challenges as well, but it really does mean you can have a small team and a really strong product. And if you've got that industry expertise, you don't need a huge, huge team to be able to take something to market and really sell it.
And that industry expertise seems so obvious again, but not everyone does that. I think, like, I see people that come to me all the time and they're, oh, we want to build a recruitment product, and then they don't actually have recruitment expertise, as an example. So they're trying to build something without truly understanding. Like, that was something you must have realized that you need to plug those gaps. That's critical, right? To build a product company, you have to have that domain knowledge.
100%. And it's just even just the credibility. You can't go to someone and try and sell, especially when it's a specific industry. You know, we could have built something on top of Salesforce and CRM, and we've got domain expertise, so we would be credible. But if we're trying to sell a retail solution into a retailer, there's no chance we can sell that without retail expertise and retail people. And we also wouldn't, you know, be confident building and knowing that we're building the right things, even though we did have those pilot customers. Can't always listen to what the customers say. It's, you know, it's not always like that. Sometimes you have to be thinking a few steps ahead of where the actual customer's thinking.
Sure. So finally, before I let you go, what does your role look like now yourself? Like, what do you do day to day?
So my role, I'm the product owner, so I'm managing, you know, the product team. So I have a product manager, testers, developers that work under me. I work basically pulling from sales, from the CEO, from customer success, from our, you know, just customers in general, just bringing all the backlog items and then trying to work through the prioritization and building out the roadmap for the future and the vision for the future. And yeah, it's good, yeah. Sort of work through all the different hats in the business, from sales, customer success, and I'm really happy just being focused on the product now and having teams that are doing those other elements. It's great.
And where does the hunger come from just to keep driving?
I think it's just, you know, we're definitely at the point now where you have a new goal every 6-12 months, and because we're achieving it, the hunger is just, you know, that next bit, that next step forward. This big round of funding is going to really push us into the next phase of the company. We'll, you know, hit 50, 100 people. And we've worked so hard at it now. We really just want to get it to the point where it just keeps growing year on year. We want to be doubling, tripling year on year for the next 5 years or so. And it's just so exciting to be in. And as I said at the start, I think it takes a certain person. And even now, yeah, COVID was a perfect example. We hit that and there was a good chance that we couldn't make it through that. If all our customers decided to turn around and say, you know, we're not going to be paying you, we have enough burn rate and not enough money in the bank that we couldn't last too long. So there was, you know, some serious conversations. And those challenges, and to get out of those challenges and work hard to get to the next stage is just a thrill. And I think it's a bit crazy and only crazy people love it. But if you're in it, it's so hard. I can't think of going back to a normal job now.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think we'll wrap up, because I think you've answered all of my questions so well in terms of, you know, I'm excited about the vision and what you're looking to achieve, and I'm sure all of our listeners and viewers will really enjoy that. So thank you so much. if anyone does want to reach out and pick your brains on anything or find out more about the business or things like that, where's the best place to kind of contact you?
Probably jump on LinkedIn, I'd say. Just and you can post, I don't even know what my LinkedIn handle, but if you search Chris Moyes, Chris with a K, I don't think there's too many of them out there, but feel free to share my LinkedIn and connect and have a chat. We're growing, so there'll be some exciting opportunities for people in the future, and looking forward to working with you as well.
Yeah, really excited to see what the future brings, and the best of luck with the next round of funding and everything that comes with it.
Thanks, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talent Hub Talk. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and also leave a short review. We're keen for this podcast to reach as many people in the Salesforce ecosystem as possible, and your reviews will help us do that.